Term limits. Not a universal feature of most democracies, surprisingly. In most parliamentary countries, you can get elected again and again and again. The US Supreme Court even issued a ruling in 1995 in which they called term limits undemocratic, saying, quote, "Term limits, like any other qualification for office, unquestionably restrict the ability of voters to vote for whom they wish." That decision struck down state laws putting term limits on members of Congress, and the only reason they didn't also strike down presidential term limits is because the Constitution kind of couldn't be clearer that you can only get elected president twice. Of course, that hasn't always been the case. The 22nd Amendment, which passed Congress in 1947 and passed into law in 1951 after being ratified by the states, established a two-term limit. For most of American history, you could run for as many terms as you wanted, and it was up to the voters to return you to office. There's a case to be made that that's more democratic. It's easy to imagine a world where that kind of argument caught on as the 22nd Amendment was making its way through Congress or the state legislatures. It's very hard to pass a constitutional amendment, deliberately so, and if a few important senators or governors had changed their minds, presidential term limits may be considered alongside things like expanding the size of the Supreme Court, interesting ideas to change the American political system that never came to pass. If presidents could keep running past two terms, how would recent history be different? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosity. As you probably know, even though any president before 1951 could run for a third term, the vast majority didn't, and only one person in American history, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, has served more than two terms as president. Because George Washington stepped down after two terms, setting an unofficial precedent that an honest president won't seek a third term, there aren't even a lot of cases of presidents running for a third term before FDR. There are, fittingly, three elections where presidents ran for a third term before FDR won his, but none of them were very successful, and I tend to see each one as an edge case. Ulysses S. Grant, who served for two terms from 1868 to 1877, was a candidate for the Republican nomination again in 1880, but against his will. He'd announced his retirement after two terms like usual, didn't run in the 1876 election, and had spent the last 4 years traveling the world. Grant desperately wanted to stay retired, and reluctantly cut short his trip around the world to run for president in 1880 because national Republicans were demanding that Grant come back and save the party from its internal divides. Incumbent Republican President Rutherford B. Hayes wasn't running for a second term, which used to be a lot more common. In the days before term limits, presidential candidates would sometimes pledge to serve just one term as a show of humility. The 1880 Republican National Convention saw a reluctant Grant as one of two main candidates, running against James G. Blaine, a senator from Maine. After many votes, with no majority winner, they settled on a dark horse compromise candidate, Congressman James Garfield from Ohio, who went on to win the election. Grant was relieved that he wouldn't be forced to serve a third term. Grant is arguably the only president who never wanted to be president, got pressured into running, and hated every minute of being president. To him, I'm sure it felt like sort of a sick joke that there was the chance that he might be the first ever president to serve more than two terms. He saw it as a terrible ordeal that he had to take upon himself for the sake of healing the country and making sure the Civil War didn't start up again, which was a real threat for almost 20 years after the war. But Garfield became president, and the US muddled through, even though Garfield was shot and gruesomely died in the first year of his presidency. The other president to seek a third term was the famous one, Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. He'd initially become president in 1901 after the incumbent William McKinley was assassinated. Roosevelt had been vice president for 6 months at that point. Young, ambitious, and charismatic, he'd been elected governor of New York in 1898 as a strong progressive. We're still sort of in the era where Republicans were the more progressive party, although that was beginning to change. When President McKinley, who'd first been elected in 1896, ran for re-election, Roosevelt's fellow Republicans in New York persuaded McKinley to name Roosevelt to the vice presidency after the previous VP, Garrett Hobart, had died in office. This was done by Roosevelt's opponents, not his supporters. Making Roosevelt vice president was intended to shut him up by putting him in a supposedly higher but less powerful office than governor of New York. Instead, 6 months later, McKinley was dead and Roosevelt was president. Roosevelt was hugely popular, served out the rest of what would have been McKinley's second term, and got elected to a full term of his own in 1904. That was the only presidential election Teddy Roosevelt ever won. For such an influential president, and almost a two-term president, he only got elected to the office of president once. In 1908, Roosevelt was eligible to run for another term, like everyone at that point, and popular enough that he'd easily have won, but having become president just 6 months into McKinley's term, he was again almost a two-term president, so he obeyed the two-term precedent. By now, he had centralized power over the Republicans enough that he was able to easily name his hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft, as the Republican nominee in 1908. Taft won, but pretty soon Roosevelt got buyer's remorse from elevating Taft to the presidency, finding him not progressive enough. Now we get to Roosevelt's 1912 campaign as the nominee for his own Progressive Party. Roosevelt was pretty successful. He won several states, one of the most recent third-party candidates to get electoral votes outside the South, and he came in second, pushing Taft down to third place in both the popular and electoral vote, the only incumbent president to ever finish third in a re-election bid. But the main effect Roosevelt had was splitting the Republican vote and allowing the Democrat Woodrow Wilson to win a landslide in the electoral vote with only 41% of the popular vote. Also, it was arguably not even a three-way election, but a four-way election, since the socialist Eugene V. Debs got 6% of the popular vote too, the high watermark for a socialist presidential candidate to this day. Technically, Roosevelt in 1912 was the most successful campaign for a third term before FDR, because unlike Ulysses S. Grant and the other one we're about to talk about, Teddy's campaign made it out of the primaries. He was actually on the ballot in the general election and won some states outright, but I barely consider this a run for a third term. Yes, Roosevelt had taken office just 6 months into McKinley's second term, so he did basically serve two terms, but 1912 was only the second presidential election where Roosevelt was a candidate. Before FDR, only Grant and Woodrow Wilson actually attempted to run in a third election after being elected president twice. Because yeah, the next president to run for a third term was the next president. Woodrow Wilson would go on to get reelected in 1916, and after his two terms, there was talk that he might go for a third, but in October 1919, with a year to go before what would have been his third election, he had a debilitating stroke and was never quite right again. Last summer, when the Trump-Biden debate happened and the whole country realized how bad Biden had gotten, I began to see people saying, has America ever been in this situation before? Even if Biden is fine, has there ever been uncertainty over whether the President of the United States is all there? Has there ever even been the possibility that the president is basically a vegetable being propped up for the cameras by his cabinet who are doing the real work? Yes, actually, that exact thing happened in the past, in the last year of Woodrow Wilson's presidency. Some people call Edith Wilson, Woodrow's wife, the first woman president because she made some decisions for her husband, along with Wilson's doctor. Wilson still insisted he wanted to run for a third term, but everyone knew he was in no fit state, and the Democratic insiders didn't let him. So then after that, there were three consecutive Republican presidents, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, then the four-term presidency of FDR. He died only 3 months into his fourth term, but he's still the only president to have won more than two national elections, and he always will be, because when Republicans took control of Congress in the aftermath of FDR's death, passing an official presidential term limit amendment was a major issue they ran on. Considering that there was already a strong movement for presidential term limits under FDR, suppose FDR's dying wish to his vice president, Truman, was to block the passage of a term limit amendment. So let's say that. President Truman loudly announces his opposition to the 22nd Amendment, which in reality he only openly opposed after it had been passed. Republicans in Congress don't care, assuming that Truman is so unpopular he'll be out of office soon anyway, but he unexpectedly wins re-election in 1948, one of the most famous upsets in American history, which gets everyone to take the opposition to the 22nd Amendment seriously. Democratic-controlled states refused to ratify it or rescind their previous ratifications, and by the time the 7-year deadline for ratification is up, the number of states that approved the amendment hasn't yet reached the necessary 2/3 of states for it to pass into law. So, that's our point of divergence. But it takes an amazingly long time for this to change anything. Throughout the 20th century, this alternate history doesn't look very alternate. The thing is, it's kind of rare for presidents to serve 2 full terms, let alone be in a position where they could run for a 3rd if they wanted. We've had a historically anomalous number of 2-term presidents in recent US history. Truman was never term limited, even in our timeline. The 22nd Amendment explicitly didn't apply to him. He decided not to run in 1952 because he was getting unpopular, and that wouldn't change in a world without the 22nd. Then we got Dwight Eisenhower, a popular 2-term moderate Republican. He could have won a 3rd term in 1960, easy. Would he have run if he could? No. At first you might think so. Eisenhower famously gave a bitter, ominous farewell speech upon handing over the presidency to JFK in 1961, in which he coined the phrase military-industrial complex. That suggests he believed he had unfinished business in office, but by 1960, Eisenhower was 70 years old and suffering from a heart condition. He'd already had a heart attack during his presidency and would have several more over the course of the 60s. He was also a magnanimous figure who only reluctantly ran for president in the first place by popular demand. As a commanding general who had been elevated to the presidency after winning a war for America, he clearly saw something of Washington in himself, in a humbling, not self-aggrandizing way. He may have been one of the least partisan presidents we've had in modern times. He'd have obeyed the 2-term precedent, even if it wasn't officially in law. And the historical perception that Eisenhower didn't trust his vice president Richard Nixon to lead the country is mostly a myth based on wishful thinking. It would be nice if Eisenhower had understood Nixon was a crook, but he didn't. He saw Nixon as a worthy successor. So, the 1960 election would have been the same as our 1960 election. Kennedy versus Nixon, extremely close, so close that maybe actually Nixon won the popular vote, and Alabama basically invented their own bizarre, unique electoral system for the 1960 election that allowed people to cast fractional votes. I have a whole video about that. And because of that, we can't be sure who really won the popular vote in 1960, but JFK won the Electoral College, so he's president. Then he's assassinated, LBJ is president, wins in a landslide in 64, becomes unpopular because of Vietnam, and declines to run again in 68. Note that if LBJ had run in 68 and somehow won again, he would have served longer than 2 terms, legally, under the terms of the 22nd Amendment. He first became president when JFK was shot in 1963, got elected in his own right the next year, and was eligible to run for another full term in 68 despite the 22nd Amendment, because the 22nd allows that if the president dies or resigns more than halfway through their term, then their vice president is allowed to seek 2 full terms of their own in addition to filling in for the rest of the president's unfilled term. That's the only way you can legally be president for more than 8 years after the 22nd Amendment was passed. In this video's timeline, this is irrelevant, but 22nd Amendment or no, LBJ is still unpopular in 68 and declines to run for a term that he's eligible for. Then Nixon's back, winning in a nail-biter in 68 and a landslide in 72. Then there's Watergate, he's out, Gerald Ford is president, Ford narrowly loses to Carter, who serves 1 term and loses big to Reagan. Reagan pulls off an even bigger landslide in 1984, and he's still popular by 1988. Finally, a full 41 years after our point of divergence, we get a different election, but not too different. Our timeline's 1988 election was the closest thing that can happen post-22nd Amendment to a president winning a 3rd term. The outgoing president's vice president, in this case George Bush Sr., won in a landslide. If that had been Reagan on the ticket, I think the election would have been basically the same. Same electoral college map, same popular vote, only it's Reagan running for a 3rd term. Would he have done that, though? Reagan was really old. He was already the oldest president yet when he was first elected in 1980. He was witty enough to dispel rumors about mental decline, dismissing concerns about his age in the 1984 election by famously saying,
"I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience."
By 1988, though, Reagan was distinctly seen as a frail old man. SNL ran a skit on the premise that Reagan was secretly a shrewd Machiavellian genius behind the scenes, which was ridiculous because obviously everyone knew him as the nation's soft-spoken grandpa, for better and for worse. Still, Reagan was the great communicator. He could probably have put out another snappy soundbite to assuage America's fears and gotten comfortably reelected. He might make a promise to America that he wouldn't seek a fourth term, complete with some bipartisan bromides about how FDR was a great man who deserves to remain our longest-serving president. The elephant in the room, though, Alzheimer's. Reagan died of Alzheimer's in 2004. A New York Times article in 1997 depicted him being shepherded around Los Angeles by his wife, only occasionally aware that he had been president. When did this start? Had it begun to hit by 1988? Even if not, would he have to step down or get propped up Woodrow Wilson style during his third term? Probably not. There are some who argue that Reagan was already experiencing Alzheimer's symptoms during his presidency, notably his son, Ron Jr., although this has been disputed by the rest of Reagan's family and is medically improbable. Reagan's doctors said he started showing symptoms in late 1992, and even that, 12 years from onset to death, is close to the upper bound for how long a person with Alzheimer's can survive. If he was suffering from it as early as 1988, that would be a very anomalous case of Alzheimer's. So in this world, Reagan would probably begin suffering from Alzheimer's towards the end of his presidency, but not noticeably enough to be diagnosed. He was still doing public events as late as 1994, and by then it would be a foregone conclusion that he was too old to run for a fourth term anyway. The politics of Reagan's third term would probably be identical to our timeline's George H.W. Bush presidency. Bush would be vice president, but gradually taking over more duties from Reagan in preparation for his own presidential run in 1992. As Reagan's main foreign policy guy, Bush would probably be seen as the one in the driver's seat for the Gulf War in 1991, which sent his popularity skyrocketing. There was an SNL skit around that time called "Avoid Being the Guy Who Loses to Bush," where SNL's cast played the top Democratic politicians expected to run in 92. This skit would probably be exactly the same in the timeline where Reagan was still president. Of course, Bush did not win in 92, but neither did any of these guys. The 1992 election shapes up to be exactly like our timeline's 1992 election. Bill Clinton is bringing youth and vigor back to the Democratic Party, Ross Perot is doing his idiosyncratic protectionist populist campaign, and George H.W. Bush is the incumbent, sort of. Here, he's the vice president, but even though Reagan doesn't have Alzheimer's yet, he's so old that everyone kinda understands Bush is the one who's really in charge. Bush comfortably defeats the Christian conservative populist Pat Buchanan in the primaries, just like in our timeline, and the election is the 1992 election, as we know it. We're coming up now on half a century since the 22nd Amendment failed, and still, history has barely changed. Two things might change, though. The way we remember the 90s, and the way we remember Reagan. Sure, in this timeline, Reagan gets to serve three terms, the second longest serving president in American history at that point, which you'd think would make people consider him the conservative FDR, every bit as foundational to American institution building as old President Hot Wheels. Remember how much Republicans worshipped Reagan in the 90s and 2000s? They'd worship him even more if he served three terms, right? But I don't think so. You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Nowhere is that truer than in politics. In our timeline, Reagan's presidency ended on a high note, as one of the most popular outgoing presidents of all time. Bush got stuck with the aftermath. In this timeline, Reagan would watch as his approval ratings declined throughout his third term, and then his handpicked successor loses in a landslide. America would be left with far less of an impression that Reaganism was a resounding success. Because the early 90s were bad, and in the three-term Reagan timeline, we'd remember that. Today there's this strong cultural narrative of the 80s and 90s as being part of a long, unbroken era of naive optimism, when the economy was booming and everyone was satisfied about everything. But America and most of the Western world went through a deep recession in the early 90s. I mean, look at the 1992 election results. You don't get that kind of landslide defeat of an incumbent when people think the country's going in the right direction. You definitely don't get a third-party campaign getting almost 20% of the popular vote unless people think the system has stopped working. Southern California was especially hard hit, posting unemployment rates they hadn't seen since the Great Depression, which is probably why Los Angeles erupted in days of citywide rioting in 1992, only ending with the largest military occupation of a US city since the Civil War. The riots were ostensibly about police brutality, but people don't riot like that in good economic times. Pop culture was getting angry and downcast. Why do you think Nirvana resonated with so many people? It was insane for bands this angsty to have mainstream hits. If you want a real piece of early 90s recession despair slop, check out the movie Falling Down. It's not a very good movie, but it's such a historical document. I'm honestly not sure such a bitterly cynical, feel-bad movie could be so successful today, even as self-satisfied Zoomers mock the 90s as one of those horrible times when people liked things, when people had those awful upward curves on their faces and had not yet internalized the wisdom of Mr. Grumpledump's song. In a world where the narrative of Reagan is less he saved the economy from the malaise of the 70s and kicked off the economic boom that defined the late 20th century, and more he couldn't fix everything, which is why everyone got sick of him by the time he was in his third term, we'd remember the recession of the early 90s more clearly as a distinct cultural era. Hell, it's possible that the cultural memory of the 90s would overcorrect the opposite way, and it would be seen as a time of utter economic desperation, when it really wasn't that either. All right, but anyway, Clinton is president throughout the 90s, and the economy gets roaring again. And at long last, 53 years after the 22nd Amendment was vetoed, we finally get to the first election that would have led to a different party controlling the White House than the one in our timeline. 2000. This was a janky election. In fact, the sheer jank of the 2000 election puts anything in the Trump era to shame. There. I said it because it's true. George Bush Jr. this time was running against Bill Clinton's vice president Al Gore. Gore was yet to devote his life to climate activism at this point, and his public image was less of a tree hugger and more just a deeply boring guy. Want to see a fantastic video?
I would like to demonstrate for you the Al Gore version of the Macarena. Would you like to see it again?
That was the popular perception of Gore back then. Aggressively square, uncharismatic in a way that really affected his electoral prospects. A common take about the 2000 election while it was underway was that the candidates were too similar, just a couple of bland moderates. This is a Rage Against the Machine music video from that year. That fueled the campaign of Ralph Nader with the Green Party, one of the most successful third-party leftist campaigns in recent memory. Despite all this, Gore still basically won, but on election night, the Electoral College was too close to call. Gore narrowly led in the popular vote, and with most of the states called, the election hinged on who won Florida. And in Florida, it seemed like everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. Several recounts of the razor-thin results were called, a poorly formatted ballot design in Palm Beach County was believed to have caused hundreds, possibly thousands, of Gore voters to accidentally cast a vote for Pat Buchanan instead, now running as a far-right third-party candidate, but those were their votes. They'd already voted. Election day was over, and they'd voted for Pat Buchanan. Other ballots were found to have had the hole punched partially through them instead of a clean punched hole for each candidate they voted for. These were called hanging chads, and whether those ballots could be counted or not was an open question. A machine recount showed Bush in the lead by 327 votes out of millions. Gore's team pushed for a manual recount instead, while Bush's team repeatedly sued to stop the recount. Bush's lead kept fluctuating as the manual recount went on, sometimes leading in Florida by only a double-digit margin. Finally, a month after Election Day, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the manual recount was logistically impossible and could stop, with Florida's final vote being fixed at a 537-vote lead for Bush. Gore conceded the next day. This was real. This really happened. That's how George W. Bush became president. But if Clinton could run for a third term, he definitely would. He was still just 54 at this point, the youngest president to serve two full terms, and he was popular, just as popular as Reagan was at his two-term mark. He'd absolutely have won in 2000, probably by a pretty big margin. Finally, I get to create a different election with a new electoral college map. We'll take the existing 2000 election and add 3 percentage points to Gore's performance, 2 subtracted from Bush and 1 subtracted from Ralph Nader. That nets Clinton Florida, of course, so he wins the election, but also Nevada, Missouri, Ohio, Tennessee, New Hampshire, and his native Arkansas. where I'm adding 10 percentage points to Gore's performance because Clinton was still popular. That's the highest popular vote margin Clinton's ever gotten. This would be the only election where Bill Clinton gets a majority of the national popular vote, not just a plurality, because for the first time in Clinton's presidency, Ross Perot isn't running and it's a two-man race. Okay, so now Clinton is president for a third term, just in time for... Oh yeah, how would Bill Clinton have responded to 9/11? The answer is probably not too differently from Bush. Clinton was a master triangulator, adopting positions from his rivals when the political winds shifted. It's difficult to exaggerate how thoroughly Americans were out for revenge after 9/11. Clinton would launch the war in Afghanistan almost immediately after the Twin Towers fell, same as Bush did. He'd talk about a global war on terror, but he most likely wouldn't extend the war to Iraq. Bush had wanted to invade Iraq since before 9/11, already taking a much more hardline position than Clinton as soon as he got into office. It was Bush's PR campaign that got Americans on board with an invasion of Iraq, even as Bush's own advisors said the justification for invading was tenuous and Saddam had no known ties to Al-Qaeda. In this timeline, that PR campaign harnesses the American public's bloodlust and directs it against Clinton. It probably takes on an anti-environmental bent as well, as one of the ways Clinton and Gore respond to 9/11 is most likely to work toward reducing America's reliance on foreign oil. Perhaps a young Elon Musk takes the stage with Clinton and Gore at the White House, promising safe and affordable electric cars for the masses, to boos from the Republicans. As the 2004 election approaches, Clinton is trying to be the first president since FDR to win a fourth term. Senator John McCain, who came second to Bush in the 2000 Republican primaries, is the favorite for the Republican nomination, crushing candidates like John Ashcroft, Christine Todd Whitman, and maybe another run by Pat Buchanan in the primaries. McCain's platform is that Iraq must be invaded, and Clinton isn't jingoistic enough. McCain needs to pick a running mate, and there's one obvious choice. The conservative Republican governor of an extremely important state, one that hasn't voted Republican in years, but at this point may still have been in reach, who is also the first black woman in American history to serve as a governor, a milestone our timeline still hasn't achieved, California Governor Condoleezza Rice. Yes, Condi Rice, known in our timeline as the Secretary of State who oversaw Bush's wars, is governor of California in this timeline, something she really did consider. She was provost of Stanford throughout the 90s and worked as an advisor to Bush's 2000 campaign on national security issues. In a world where Bush lost, Rice would probably be a prime candidate for California governor. The incumbent Democratic governor, Gray Davis, was unpopular and would eventually get recalled and replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Rice managed the incredibly rare feat of being an accomplished, charismatic, black woman who is a Republican. That's a unicorn if there ever was one. She'd win in 2002. And she'd be a no-brainer for a vice presidential pick. McCain and Rice spend the election season attacking Clinton as soft on terrorism. Clinton ramps up strikes on Afghanistan in an attempt to dispel this image, but McCain narrowly wins, making Bill Clinton the only president to be defeated after having served multiple terms, and tying him with Reagan. I'm just using the real-life 2004 election as the Electoral College template here, except again adding 10 percentage points to Arkansas because even at this point, they wouldn't vote against their favorite son. McCain is president, the first Republican since Reagan to win the popular vote, or to win the presidency at all, since in this timeline, every candidate in modern times who wins the popular vote wins the Electoral College. McCain launches an invasion of Iraq less than a month into his presidency, backed by most of Congress. It's even more of a mess than our timeline's Iraq War. Saddam Hussein has had years to prepare, and he holds on to power well into 2005. American troops sustain much heavier losses than in our timeline's war. McCain's honeymoon is rapidly over. In 2006, George Bush Jr. steps down after three terms as governor of Texas, handing the reins to his lieutenant governor, Rick Perry. The governor of Texas doesn't have any term limits, not in our timeline or this one. Bush got a fair deal out of losing the 2000 election. Hell, so did his dad. Neither of the George Bushes got to be president in this timeline, but they had long, respectable political careers that didn't involve any war crimes. Their historical image is more like the Romneys, a staid, all-American political dynasty, likable regardless of partisanship. Lots of alternate histories where George W. Bush doesn't get to be president have him ending up as the commissioner of Major League Baseball, since he was the owner of the Texas Rangers before he got into politics. Sure, let's let him have that. Let's say he was commissioner during the time that Bud Selig was actually commissioner. Meanwhile, John McCain is shouldering the blame for the intensifying and increasingly unpopular Iraq and Afghanistan wars. The goodwill that McCain carried throughout his life in our timeline as a Vietnam War hero and moderate voice in the Republican Party is completely gone. A charismatic young senator from Illinois is about to become his challenger. Obama might have had a much clearer path to the nomination than he did in our timeline's 2008, since Hillary Clinton isn't running. In fact, Hillary doesn't have much of a political career at all in this timeline. In our timeline, she ran for Senate from New York in 2000, but she wouldn't do that if her husband was still the incumbent president. And in 2008, in this video's timeline, Bill was president just 4 years ago, and the Democrats want new blood. The 2008 Democratic primaries in the No Term Limits universe might pit Obama against stronger campaigns by John Edwards, Joe Biden, maybe even Gore. It might come down to Obama versus Gore. Or Bill Clinton could be back, running for a non-consecutive fourth term. That's perfectly likely. Either way, Obama wins the primaries anyway, even if Bill is a candidate, since Obama beat Hillary in our timeline. In our timeline, the Bush administration was already unpopular when 2008 began, and they slid further as the economy started to crumble. I think Obama could have done much better than his already impressive performance if he hadn't been running against John McCain, who most Americans saw as a good guy regardless of politics. Well, 2008 in this timeline is still McCain versus Obama, and McCain doesn't have the liability of Sarah Palin on his ticket this time, but I think Obama would win bigger than he did in our 2008, because McCain here is saddled with Bush's unpopular wars. In our 2008, McCain was able to distance himself from Bush, at least a little. Here, it's McCain who is the warmonger president. Here, the bumper stickers say McCain lied, people died. His time as a prisoner of war in Vietnam rings hollow in light of the thousands of Americans he has sent to similar fates. Compared to our timeline's 2008 election, I'd bump up Obama's performance by a margin of 4 percentage points of the popular vote, which results in this electoral map. Missouri goes blue, notably, allowing its old status as a bellwether to temporarily survive. The Obama presidency unfolds more or less as you remember it. Obamacare passes. With Obama's coattails, there are probably a few more Democratic senators than in our timeline, but the Affordable Care Act is probably still more or less the same. There was enough internal party opposition to the Obamacare public option that I think that still wouldn't have passed. The Libertarian Tea Party movement emerges as the organized opposition to Obama, but the nominee against him in 2012 is moderate Mitt Romney. Romney loses, and both Democrats and Republicans begin to unironically consider if Republicans will ever win the presidency again. Then, in the summer of 2015, Trump comes down that golden escalator. Obama wants to be magnanimous and revives a two-term precedent. Michelle is urging him to move the family back to Chicago and let the world turn without him. But just like FDR seeing the war developing in Europe in 1940, Obama senses that the world is about to change, and America needs strong leadership. He announces a bid for a third term. Obama makes a real effort to beat Trump, to the extent that other Democrats are confused about why he thinks Trump is such a serious challenger. He's gonna lose, right? Biden is aging and has just lost his son to cancer and wants some time to grieve. Obama replaces him with a running mate handpicked to shore up white working class support, former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer. This is part of an overall push from Obama to steal Trump's populist thunder. There were pre-election rumors that Bernie Sanders might challenge Obama in the 2016 primaries. Obama instead quietly promises Bernie a cabinet position of his choice if he campaigns for Obama. Obama is not going to let himself get caught off guard, and on election day he wins by a pretty big margin, a slightly wider margin than he beat Romney with, but still not the landslide everyone was expecting. Trump still manages to flip two classic bellwethers, Iowa and Ohio. The way I constructed this election was by shaving one percentage point off from Jill Stein's performance, because I think most of the people who voted for her specifically voted because they hate Hillary. Two percentage points get subtracted from Trump himself, and all those get added to Hillary's margin to make Obama's performance in 2016. This leaves one state extremely close. Arizona, which Obama didn't win in either 2008 or 2012, not in this video's timeline nor the real world. I could go into the raw vote totals and determine who wins Arizona in this scenario, but I want this world to have a fun, janky election like 2000. All the elections in this universe have been disarmingly normal so far. So let's say in this Obama versus Trump 2016, Arizona is too close to call. Recount after recount is done, continuing weeks after the election is called for Obama nationwide. Trump tries to dispute the election like he did in 2020, but there's no reaction. He has no allies. Trump's name was mud in the Republican Party right up until he won. Every Republican in office was preparing their good riddance speech for when Trump lost. After he really does lose, the GOP's knives are out. He's done. But he still might have won Arizona. The recounts finally come to an end around Thanksgiving with an extraordinary announcement from Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. They have confirmed that Arizona is literally a tie, something that has never happened before in US presidential history. They've counted all the votes, and there's an equal number for Trump and for Obama. What happens now? Arizona law says that the outcome of a tied election gets decided, quote, by lot, which could mean flipping a coin or drawing names out of a hat in the presence of both candidates. So Obama, who has already won and is trying to be a great unifier after this bitter election, suggests to Trump that they make a day of it. They'll both fly to Arizona, shake hands, deliver some platitudes about faith in democracy. Then Secretary of State Michelle Reagan pulls a name out of a hat, and whoever it is, that's the winner of Arizona's electoral votes. They'll congratulate whichever of them won, and Obama will go back to the White House and Trump back to Mar-a-Lago. Trump refuses, insisting he won Arizona fair and square and the election was rigged, which falls on deaf ears in the GOP. So Obama flies to Arizona by himself. The Secretary of State pulls Trump's name out of the hat, but according to the state law, both candidates need to be present. Only Obama is there, so by not showing up, Trump has forfeited his claim to Arizona's electoral votes. A state court confirms that, yes, that's the law, and Obama is certified as having won Arizona. That's the final electoral vote haul for 2016. Relative to 2012, Obama flipped two states, Arizona and North Carolina, and Trump flipped two states, Iowa and Ohio. Obama's share of the popular vote is almost identical to his vote share against Romney. That's a stronger performance by Trump than anyone really expected, and Obama understands he needs to undertake a progressive populist push to win back Trump's base. For Obama's third-term cabinet, Bernie Sanders is named Secretary of Labor, and Elizabeth Warren becomes Secretary of Commerce. Also, because of Obama's coattails, Dems won two Senate races in 2016 that they didn't win in real life. Katie McGinty in Pennsylvania and Jason Kander in Missouri both defeat Republican incumbents. That puts the Senate at 50-50, which, with Vice President Brian Schweitzer to break ties, means a functional Democratic majority. But not for long, because Sanders and Warren vacated their Senate seats in Vermont and Massachusetts to serve in Obama's cabinet, and even though those are among the bluest states, both those states had moderate Republican governors in 2017, who would be empowered to appoint Republicans to those seats. Obama strikes a deal with Governors Phil Scott of Vermont and Charlie Baker of Massachusetts. They can appoint Republicans to fill those seats for the first few months of 2017, as long as they schedule special elections to happen by 4th of July, which Democrats will probably win. Both understand that opposing Obama in their very progressive states is bad politics, and they agree to that plan. Phil Scott appoints former Governor Jim Douglas to Vermont's seat, and Charlie Baker appoints former Senator Scott Brown in Massachusetts. Both of them announce that they're running for full terms. Special elections in both states are scheduled for the 4th of July 2017, since it happens to be a Tuesday. The Democratic nominees in both special elections are interesting. In Vermont, we get the first trans senator, a milestone our timeline hasn't yet had, with Vermont Electric CEO Christine Hallquist defeating Jim Douglas. And in Massachusetts, the Democratic establishment choice, Mo Cowan, a lawyer who already briefly served as an appointed senator in 2013, is defeated in the Democratic primary by RFK Jr. Sure, he lives in New York, but he's a Kennedy. He can win Massachusetts. The Democrats reluctantly accept RFK Jr. as their nominee, even if he's a bit too left-wing for most of them. With high turnout on the holiday, Democrats win, as expected, and the Senate is back to being 50-50. They start slinging out lots and lots of judicial appointments, filling all the vacant judgeships that, in our timeline, were being blocked by Mitch McConnell from 2014 to 16 and were filled under Trump. Liberals control the federal judiciary for the foreseeable future. So, it's 2017 and Obama is still president. Does that mean Mumford & Sons will still have hits and people will still be saying "Le Epic Bacon" all the way up to 2020? I wish! God, I wish! But no. The cultural quote-unquote Obama era already ended before the Obama presidency ended, in 2014 with Ferguson and Gamergate and DashCon. Trump wasn't the cause of the era of conflict and division that started around then. He was a symptom. And most of the biggest progressive causes and movements of the first Trump era weren't directly about Trump and would still be going on even with Obama in the White House eloquently urging calm. Most notably, climate change. I think it's difficult to exaggerate how front and center climate change was to the zeitgeist in the late 2010s. We don't talk about how, during the first Trump term, the whole left saw climate change as really the only thing that matters, because it forces us to admit that today that's not how we view climate change. Not leftists, not liberals, not anyone. It's still going on, of course. It's still a pressing issue, and anyone to the left of Mitt Romney will admit that if asked, but it's gone way down our list of priorities. Talking about things like the trillionth ton, 350 parts per million, doomsday glaciers, not having kids because of climate change, youth climate activists as huge mainstream celebrities, referring to forest fires as climate fires, all that feels every bit as dated as saying epic bacon. This is really just my observation, and I can't point to hard data to back it up. Google Ngram Viewer only goes to 2022 and shows use of the phrase climate change consistently rising until then. I was able to find one source from 2022 that showed the use of the term climate change in the New York Times peaked in 2019, but it didn't go down very far after that and it could just be noise. Let me know if you've noticed this too. Anyway, in Obama's third term, we still get the angry progressive movement that typified the resistance to Trump's first term. Since Obama trounced Trump, there's no vote blue no matter who. Gen Z has grown up seeing Obama's presidency as a constant like the sun, moon, and stars. Bernie Sanders didn't build a movement, but he's in Obama's cabinet now, so he's just part of the problem. The left doesn't gain nearly as much cultural power as it did under Trump, but a lot of the same protests we think of in our timeline as being against Trump still happen against Obama. There's probably no women's march in DC, and pop feminism in general is probably less of a cultural juggernaut in this timeline, but there may be a march in DC almost as big accusing Obama of not doing enough about climate change. But, of course, when the president is a Democrat, the median voter doesn't swing left, they swing right. Ordinary Americans become more anti-LGBT, anti-immigration, anti-environmental, and pro-capitalist. The right, however, is adrift. They can't capitalize on this. Just like how right now in real life Trump is less popular than he's ever been, but Democrats are also at record low popularity because nobody agrees on what Dems stand for or should start standing for, Republicans in this timeline's 2017 are reeling from the impact of Trump on their party. The elected officials are unified against Trump, but Trump still commands a cult-like following, smaller than the one in our timeline, but impossible to ignore if you want to win. So the third Obama term is a time of turbulence between an angry, unified far left and an angry, chaotic far right. The common wisdom that the far left does nothing but call other leftists Nazis, whereas the far right tolerates a surprising range of different ideologies because their only real cause is loyalty to one guy, that dynamic is flipped in this world. In Obama's third term, the far right is a maelstrom of infighting between Christian conservatives, post-Christian fascists, libertarians, the new tech right, each one divided into pro and anti-Trump camps, all going at each other's throats, calling each other communists, while the far left is in agreement about what they're fighting, climate change, and who's responsible for it, Barack Obama. A lot of the social trends we observed in our timeline towards the end of the Biden era, Gen Z becoming conservative, a bizarre alliance forming between Silicon Valley and the Christian right, the emergence of a centrist democratic faction focused on deregulation, the use of Israel as a wedge issue to divide leftists and liberals, even on the surface apolitical stuff like a new cultural interest in psychedelics. All those things start happening about 4 years earlier than in our timeline, under Obama's third term. And yet, other than the social unrest, the late 2010s were objectively not that bad. The economy was booming. As the far left and far right squabble, Obama would be really good at presenting himself as a unifying figure of reason. The extremely online left would attack his use of progressive populists in his cabinet as meaningless pandering, but that would resonate with ordinary people. And the Republicans would still be torn apart by internal divisions over Trump and Trumpism, unable to make a coherent case for themselves. By 2018, Obama's approval ratings are probably at heights not seen since the early days of his presidency, no matter what people are saying on Twitter. I think the midterms could plausibly look not too different from the 2018 midterms in our timeline. There definitely wouldn't be as much of a blue wave, but possibly enough for Dems to retake the House majority for the first time since 2008, A lot of important states had unpopular term-limited Republican governors, so the new crop of Democratic governors that 2018 brought in, Gretchen Whitmer, J.B. Pritzker, Tony Evers, Michelle Lujan Grisham, they'd still win. The Senate math was brutal no matter what. Dems lost 4 Senate seats in real-life 2018, and that was fewer than expected. In Obama's third term 2018, Joe Manchin and John Tester would probably lose their seats too. McConnell's back as majority leader, no more confirming justices. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably saw that coming and retired back in 2017. There's a long-lasting liberal majority on the Supreme Court. There's one banner election in this timeline's 2018 that doesn't happen in ours. A primary challenge in Massachusetts. After just a year and a half in the Senate, RFK Jr. is too progressive for most Democrats. Obama and his allies search for a normie liberal candidate with big name recognition to challenge him for his Senate seat, and they hit upon Ben Affleck, who really did consider running for Senate in Massachusetts once, in real life. A strange, strange primary campaign develops. The wacky maverick extremist versus the party insider with the president's endorsement. The scion of America's most powerful political dynasty versus the Hollywood actor with no political experience. Guess which is which. Ultimately, there's no running against a Kennedy in the Bay State. For the second time in as many years, RFK defeats the mainstream candidate in a close Democratic primary. This cements RFK Jr. as the voice of the progressive opposition to Obama. The squad progressives still enter the House in this 2018, but as anti-Obama firebrands, and their patron in the Senate is environmental hero RFK Jr., gussied up by glowing op-eds in coastal news magazines, presented as the only elected Democrat taking climate change seriously. Now we get to 2020. Already pretty popular beforehand, Obama would be able to summon something of a rally around the flag effect at the start of COVID, similar to other foreign leaders at the time, but the honeymoon rapidly faded for all of them, and Obama would be no different. In March, Obama is posting career-high approval ratings. By June, they've plummeted. George Floyd is killed and the left erupts in protest. Obama is the main target of BLM protesters' anger, and the legacy media agrees, calling him an Uncle Tom and predicting, without any real statistics, that Black America will never vote for him again. Again, Obama wants to retire. Again, global events and his party force him not to. Again, I want to create a good janky election. 2020 ends up as a four-way race. On the Republican side, Trump runs again, while the anti-Trump Republicans select an electable candidate in a smoke-filled room before the primaries start. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The primaries are a death match between Trump and Haley, with Haley in particular dodging rioters, swattings, and an assassination attempt. The shooter misses by inches. Trump pointedly refuses to condemn him. But ultimately, everybody knows that the Republican primaries are a charade that doesn't matter. Whichever of them wins the primaries, the other one will run third party. And that's what happens. Haley wins the primaries, boosted by the presence of Kanye West in a distant third, capturing the far-right anti-Trump vote. Trump forms the America First Party and keeps running. Obama sails through the primaries to be renominated for a fourth term, but RFK Jr. accepts a draft movement and runs with the Green Party. His running mate is Portland anti-police protest leader Teresa Rayford. If you log into Twitter, or read The Guardian or The New Republic, the day before the 2020 election, you get the impression that it's going to be a landslide for RFK Jr. based on his strength with Black voters who are drawn to his strong stances on climate change and defunding the police. Yeah, he's not polling well compared to Obama, Trump, or Haley. Yeah, the polls say Black voters are the least likely group of Democrats to care strongly about climate change, but the polls have been wrong before, right? They underestimated Trump, right? Not enough for him to win, but a little bit, right? Turns out the polls are pretty accurate. A weary Obama limps into his fourth term, only the second president to ever achieve that, with the lowest popular vote share of his whole career, but the best electoral college haul. His strongest constituency is, once again, Black voters. Haley and RFK Jr. each win one state, Utah and Vermont, respectively, making this the first election since 1860 in which four separate candidates win states. RFK Jr.'s base is actually the whitest of all four candidates, yes, including Trump, but that doesn't stop newspapers from running op-eds about how the only reason anyone could ever vote against RFK is if they're an unrepentant white supremacist. Only six states give a majority to any candidate, two for Trump and four for Obama. The Senate stays in Republican hands, the House flips red too, albeit just by a few seats, and the Haley-Trump split trickles down into Congress when Kevin McCarthy goes through 171 rounds of voting, lasting into February, until he's confirmed as House Speaker. With an anti-vaxxer as the face of the progressive movement, the COVID vaccine rollout is even more of a mess, with university campuses playing host to super spreader events. Black bloc anarchist protesters in major cities demand reopening and a return to normal. This was a phenomenon on the international left to an extent. In the UK, Jeremy Corbyn was against vaccine mandates, and the French left led weekly anti-vaxxer marches in Paris in summer 2021, but the US is too polarized for that to have manifested. But in a world where RFK Jr. stayed on the left and became a progressive darling, COVID polarizes the other way. After all, the last pandemic scare in the US was Ebola in 2014, and it was definitely the right stirring up hysteria about Ebola. Back then, I remember the news talking about how obviously it's inherent to the conservative worldview to be more afraid of disease. Of course, it's the natural order of things that Republicans panic more about a pandemic. In this world, that state of affairs holds. The brief trend in January 2020 where fear of COVID got dismissed as anti-Chinese racism lasts the whole way through the pandemic. Liberals accept that COVID is dangerous, but not as much as conservatives. Leftists refuse, and that drives progressives even further from Obama. The left's new allegation against Obama is that he's a warmonger eager to nuke China. 3 months into Obama's fourth term, he surpasses FDR's record. He is now the longest-serving president in American history. At that point, with the botched Afghanistan withdrawal on his hands and the Delta variant spike reminding everyone COVID is far from over, he's also one of the least popular. Republicans hold House and Senate majorities blocking most of his agenda, but the Supreme Court has a reliable liberal majority. In Ruto v. Common Cause, they ban partisan gerrymandering, requiring every state to appoint a nonpartisan redistricting commission. In Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, they strengthen and uphold the right to an abortion. Citizens United gets overturned, banning dark money and establishing new campaign spending limits. After two consecutive election losses, Trump's career is dead. The entire right has turned against him, blaming him for Obama's soon-to-be 16-year presidency, and he returns dejected to Mar-a-Lago, albeit not facing any criminal penalties because he never got into a position of power sufficient to commit any crimes. Haley isn't well-regarded either, though, and Republicans, newly free of the infighting that Trump brought, start forming think tanks and focus groups to craft a new platform that represents a break from both the old guard and the Trump era, and can be appealing to both groups. Elon Musk announces he's autistic on SNL, which RFK Jr., at that moment selling out stadiums alongside AOC on his Fighting Oligarchy speaking tour, seizes on as a line of attack. "No wonder he's so crazy," says the voice of the American left. A moral panic against autistic people begins to brew. Progressives become interested in Simon Baron Cohen's theory that autism represents the extreme male brain. They read scholarship about how autistic people have lower empathy and the controversial suggestion that Hitler was autistic, which, for the record, is something real historians believe and I think there's real evidence for. This becomes a grand unified theory of the right, very popular on progressive social media. No wonder Republicans supported the COVID vaccine so much. They want to turn your kids into autistic rationalist tech billionaires who vote for them. Back in the heady days of 2000's new atheism, some on the left embraced religion as the magic bullet reason right-wingers are the way they are. More recently, they said, racism explains it all as the reason right-wingers are the way they are. But no, that can't be it either. Racism doesn't cause a lack of empathy. A lack of empathy causes you to be racist. What's the root cause of that? What's the reason people are conservative? Autism, say progressives in this world. They're not all autistic, of course, but they are brainless sheeple who believe misinformation because they have no critical thinking. And the oligarchs who spread that misinformation, now they're all autistic. If you just cure autism, they say, Republicans will never win again. Progressive candidates lining up for the 2024 election jockey for the coveted endorsement from Autism Speaks, which itself begins to become a bit like the new ACLU, venturing into litigating progressive causes that don't have anything to do with autism at all. A handful of autistic progressive activists, like Greta Thunberg and Virginia gubernatorial candidate Lee Carter, try to push back against this new consensus, but they get treated a bit like the handful of leftists that are still pro-AI, and Thunberg begins to flirt with the far right because the far left rejects her so thoroughly now. Liberals are like, "Why do you hate autistic people now? Don't you support minorities?" To which they always get the same stump speech. "No, you idiot. Leftists don't always support minorities. Rich people are a minority too, but they're not oppressed. They're an oppressor class. And autistic people are oppressors too." The 2022 midterms are a red wave, the biggest since 2010 and resulting in some of the largest House and Senate majorities Republicans have ever had since, in 2010, the Democrats had huge congressional majorities beforehand, whereas in 22, the GOP already had narrow majorities in the House and Senate. As the first election after Rucho v. Common Cause and the overturn of Citizens United got handed down, banning gerrymandering and dark money, some Democrats hoped that fairer maps and fairer rules would give them a chance at taking back Congress. But more competitive districts mean that any wave election is a bigger wave, and the end of Citizens United hands Republicans an opportunity to say, "See, we're not actually funded by billionaires, we literally believe this stuff." And getting Trump out of the way has allowed the GOP to get their groove back. Finally, they have a unified message of reducing inflation by cutting spending, anti-wokeness, mid-20th century nostalgia, and taking COVID seriously. After 14 years of thermostatic backlash under Obama, Americans are ready for it. With just a few seats short of a supermajority in both chambers, Republicans look toward impeaching Obama. What for? That's an afterthought. How about botching the COVID vaccine rollout? Sure. Slick, young, mask-wearing Republicans like J.D. Vance lay the blame for the millions dead in the pandemic right at Obama's feet. The articles of impeachment sail through the House and are defeated in the Senate by a single vote, Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who, as a doctor himself, understands that the whole anti-vax movement is a fringe leftist cause and refuses to smear Obama as an anti-vaxxer, because he never was. Everyone assumes Obama is finally going to retire at the end of his fourth term. When October 7th happens, he loses the last iota of goodwill he had with the left. His approval ratings drop below 20%. Democrats, both moderate and progressive, line up for the most crowded primary in the party's history. When Vice President Brian Schweitzer enters the race, that's seen as a tacit admission Obama's not running. He declines to endorse anyone, knowing by this point his brand is kryptonite. The Republican primary is crowded too, but at least they have a clear frontrunner, leading in polls and endorsements from the start, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, of course. DeSantis wins enough primaries that he's treated as the presumptive nominee early on in spring 2024, allowing him to start campaigning for president long before a nominee emerges from the Democratic slugfest. Schweitzer pulls off the nomination on the Democrat side, aided by a last-second flip-flop on funding Israel, but with the lowest number of delegates of any major party nominee in decades. Many of the progressive candidates decline to endorse Schweitzer. RFK Jr. rebuffs calls to run again, endorsing Schweitzer and half-heartedly encouraging party unity, but nobody is fired up about Brian Schweitzer, and he can't meaningfully distance himself from Obama's unpopularity. DeSantis wins in a blowout, with the largest popular and electoral vote haul for a Republican since Reagan in '88. All the canonical seven swing states go red, plus Virginia, Minnesota, New Mexico, New Hampshire, and the election's real surprise, New Jersey. He begins to amass one of the most far-right cabinets America has ever seen. Josh Hawley is Attorney General, Candace Owens is the White House Press Secretary, Taylor Lorenz, a former leftist radicalized by COVID, is named Secretary of Health and Human Services and rapidly announces more required COVID vaccinations and mandatory masking in government buildings. 4 years after the pandemic hit, wearing a mask is fully cemented as a right-coded phenomenon. DeSantis and Congress, now with Republican supermajorities in both houses for the first time since the Reconstruction era, embark on a careful, deliberate project to undo all the social and political change of the 16-year Obama presidency, starting with the most popular element of their plan, making it impossible for there to ever be a 16-year presidency again. The 2020s may be the most bitterly divided political era in living memory, but for the first time since the 70s, Congress passes a constitutional amendment by the required two-thirds majorities, sending it to the states for ratification. Nobody will be elected president more than twice. In time, Obama will probably be mentioned in the same breath as FDR, as one of the all-time greats. The only other four-term president led America through a great economic crisis and a great international crisis, and so did Obama. The 2008 recession was his Great Depression, the pandemic was his World War II. He'll be studied in school for centuries. In time, people will forget how unpopular he got in his fourth term. Truman had similarly low approval ratings toward the end, and historians now consider him one of the best presidents. Democrats are in disarray. DeSantis is running roughshod over the Constitution. Nobody is sure if there even is a direction for Dems to go. The very prospect of having a Republican president at all is new and scary, or new and exhilarating, to young Americans who grew up knowing only Obama. But now you know what would happen if the U.S. had no term limits. It wouldn't be that different. Because you've all spent enough time on the internet to know that nothing ever happens.
Man,